Well, I've been doing a lot of reading this week, particularly reading with some interest an article that was written by Ed Harrell. Ed is a historian who also is a member of the church. I have heard him preach on a number of occasions, but as a historian, he has written an article called The Rise of the Church of Christ Denomination. If you're interested in getting a hold of that article, I can make it available to you. It really is interesting reading. And he talks about things that happened in this country shortly after the Civil War. Civil War is a really defining moment in our country. And by the year 1900 or around that time, 1900 to 1910, it appeared that the restoration movement in our country that we're heirs of had begun to splinter. It had gone in really kind of three directions. One side became what we now know as the Disciples of Christ. They typically use instruments when they get together for worship. And the other two splinter groups that were a part of the Restoration originally don't use instrumental music. One became what we know as the Church of Christ, but characterized more as a denomination. And the other group, and this is where I would put our group, became known as the Church of Christ. And we strive, we really struggle to be non-denominational. It made me think as I read about these things, about my experience when I first got married. And I just want to point this out, not that it deserves any great praise, but for the first 16 years that Kim and I were married, more than half the time, someone who was not a member of our family lived with us. My kids just figured that, you know, it was your room until the next person moved in. And then we moved you in with your sister and we gave your room to somebody else. Kim and I were always blessed to have a big enough house that we could do that. Now, we had folks that were family that lived with us. We had folks that were members of the church that lived with us. We had some folks that weren't members of the church that lived with us. But the common denominator was that everybody that lived with us was having a difficult time and they needed a place to stay. As I say, we did that for about 16 years, and there were some good things about it, and there were some bad things about it. We decided to stop doing that when one young lady that was living with us decided that she wanted to be married to me. And so she was going to take whatever steps she could to break up our marriage. And we asked her to leave, and I still don't know why on earth she would want to be married with me after having lived in my house, but she did. And so we have decided that that was not the best approach, and we have not continued to do that. But it made me think. A lot of people suggest that Christians don't serve the communities where they live. So that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about how Christians in the kingdom serve in their communities. And the place to begin, of course, is Jesus. Jesus is the king. He is the one who reigns over everything. But in the 13th chapter of John, you find something really surprising that happens. I think the apostles were even taken aback by what had happened. Jesus is gathering with them to begin to celebrate the Passover. It's the time when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper and told us that we should participate in that. But before they celebrated the Passover, Jesus did something really surprising. And he revealed the scepter of his kingdom. When we think about a scepter, we generally think about a sword. That's the symbol of the king. That's the way that the king reigns. Jesus reigns completely differently than anybody else. That's because, as we've said many times, things are just different in the kingdom. So John, the 13th chapter, we're going to begin reading at verse 1. It was just before the Passover feast, John says. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world, go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress. The devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. He knew that he had come from God and was returning to God. So, knowing that, he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Imagine the king, who knows that he is going back to God to, as Daniel describes it, take up his rightful place, sit on the throne next to his Father. The thing that he does is he washes the disciples' feet. Now, of course, Peter has a hard time with that. He came to Simon Peter. Peter said to him, "Lord, you're not going to wash my feet." Jesus said, "You do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you'll understand." "No," Peter said, "you'll never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. You're clean, though not every one of you." Remember, he knows Judas is going to betray him. He knew who was going to betray him. That's why he said not everyone was clean. When he finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes. He returned to his place at the table. And he asked them this question: "Do you understand what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that's what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should wash one another's feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, or is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you'll be blessed if you do them." Jesus served. And in the kingdom, people serve just like Jesus did, as they have been blessed by God. And every one of us is blessed in a different way. In First Peter, the 4th chapter, beginning at verse 10, Peter says, "Each one of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as a faithful servant of God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength God provides, so that all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and the power forever and ever. And that made me think about how we serve. Small things matter a lot to God. In Matthew, the 10th chapter, Jesus is sending out his disciples. And he gives them this instruction. He says, anyone who welcomes you welcomes me. So when I look at Harvey, I get to see Jesus. When I look at Pat, I get to see Jesus. He says, anyone who welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. So if I see Jesus, I get to see God. Whoever welcomes a prophet as a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. Whoever welcomes a righteous person as a righteous person will receive a righteous person's reward. If anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones who is my disciples, truly I tell you, that person will certainly not lose their reward. And you know, Jesus reiterated that, reinforced that idea, and he reminds us that sometimes little things matter a lot more than big things. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, he tells a story about a widow who cast into the treasury such a small, small amount. The best I can figure, what she cast into the treasury when she came to worship God was worth in total about a third of a penny. It was the smallest bit of coinage that any Roman ever saw. So let's read the record. As he taught, Jesus said, watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at the banquets. They devour widows' houses for a show, make long prayers. How incongruous. These men will be punished most severely. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put, and he watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins worth only a few cents. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth. She, out of her poverty, put in everything, all that she had to live on. And I was reading a commentator who was talking about this particular passage. And what he said really struck me. Christ might have said, see how these rich men can offer openly, in the temple. How much better it would be to give private aid to the poor widow. That would be real love. This is but paraded zeal. He might have said this, but he didn't. Instead, directing his attention to what the poor widow had done for them, he pointed to what they, in spite of their poverty, do. Instead of teaching his disciples liberality toward them, he bids us learn from their liberality. You see, the fact is, God wants hearts. He doesn't want coins, and he only wants coins when they carry the heart with them. Now, we have a hard time explaining that to the people that are around us. I think back to the time of the Civil War. There were over 500,000 men who died in the Civil War. And it wasn't just men, it was women, children, slaves, freemen. The carnage was awful. Something like 2% of the entire population of the United States died during that one conflict. It is the bloodiest conflict in which we have ever engaged. I don't know how many orphans there were at the end of the war. But I do know that there were a lot of efforts to take care of the orphans. And it seems like there were two different kinds of efforts made to care for those orphans. One grew up mostly in the South, the other mostly in the North. In the South, following the war, families took in their orphans. They just incorporated them into their family. They just, I don't know if they formally adopted them, but they just took them in. They became a part of their family. That's the way they cared for them. A family took care of an orphan. In the North, they built great orphans' homes. And those orphans' homes sometimes were able to care for many, many kids in one place. In fact, someone said that one of the orphans' homes in the North had over 1,000 kids. Now let's think about that for a minute. In the North, they built big orphans' homes. And it was easy to point to what folks were doing in the North to care for the orphans. Not so easy in the South. In fact, a lot of people said, well, you folks in the South, you don't care about orphans because you don't have any big facilities that we can point to. You don't have these places that can care for 1,000 kids. You don't have something that the newspapers can write about. And yes, the newspapers did write about it. G.M. Gordon wrote an article in the Natchez Weekly Democrat in 1872. He described an orphanage in Lauderdale, Mississippi. It was specifically set up in 1863 for children who were orphans when their fathers died in the Civil War. The Christians who headed the orphanage believed there was a debt of gratitude that needed to be paid, and that it could not be paid in a better way than providing for their children. The majority of the men who died had been extremely poor. They had left nothing to care for their children. About 100 people. 100 kids. And it was easy to point to the effort that they were making. And that's not to say anything about the young slave children who were freed, of course, at the end of the war, but they were considered contraband, and they went and lived in contraband camps. And those contraband camps were incredible. Not in a good way. Some cared for as many as a dozen students. Some had 100. Is it true that people who took in their brother's child didn't do anything? They only cared for one. They didn't care for 100. And which was better? I did some research to look at charitable giving among different income groups in our country. It turns out that in the year 2000, the Social Capital Community Benchmark Survey showed that households with incomes below $20,000, that's households with incomes below $20,000 in 2000, gave 4.6% of their income to charity, higher than any other income group. Who makes the biggest impact? Is it Bill Gates giving millions and millions and millions of dollars? Or is it the poor folks? Households earning between $50,000 and $100,000 donated 2.5% or less. Less than half of what the poor folks donated. Only above income levels over $100,000 did the percentage begin to rise from 2.5%. And they also discovered that baby boomers are the most generous. People between 49 and 67 year olds account for 43% of charitable giving. Each one gives about $1,200 per year, that same survey found. And because we have to deal with people that see what Bill Gates gives, it's tempting to seek out some great service, something that would demand incredible wealth, when the most service is often the meager service of individuals. I was living in Alaska, and way up north by Barrow, the sea ice came fast into shore. And it did that every year. But this one particular year, it came in a little early. And anyway, it trapped three whales. They couldn't get through that sea ice to free themselves. And of course, they would have died. People went nuts. The Soviets sent an icebreaker. Europe sent all kinds of equipment. We did fantastic things to try to free those whales. None of it worked. You know who freed the whales? One native guy got his chainsaw and he walked out on the ice and he used his chainsaw and he cut a hole in the ice and he took the end of a broom and he pushed down on the one side of the slab that he cut, and he pushed it over underneath the sea ice, and the whales swam from their hole where they were over to the new hole. And he walked over a little bit further, and he cut another hole, and he did the same thing, and the whales swam over, and they came up in the new hole. All that money. And all that effort that people put into it, it was that one native guy who knew how to get those whales free. Somebody would have said, well, he didn't do anything. But it wouldn't have been one of the whales. I remember seeing and reading about terrible floods that have happened in, well, just all over the country. And I read about people who respond to what's been going on with the floods. And I read about a group of people, we know them as Mennonites. They would roll into town in a school bus. Everybody had a shovel and a broom. And they got off the bus, and they just immediately went to work shoveling out people's houses, using brooms and mops, helping them to get back to normal. And nobody ever took a picture of that. Nobody ever wrote about that in the newspaper. Nobody ever acknowledged that what they were doing had any value at all. In fact, if a camera crew showed up and tried to take pictures of the Mennonites, they went and got back on the bus because they didn't want anybody to give them credit. So that brings me to my kingdom service. And I know small things mean a lot. In Acts, the 9th chapter, beginning in verse 43, we read about a woman named Tabitha. In Joppa, that's where she lived, in Greek, her name was Dorcas. She was always doing good, helping the poor. About that time, she became sick and she died. Her body was washed and placed in an upstairs room. Lydda was near Joppa. So when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men to him and urged him, "Please come at once." Peter went with them. When he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room. All the widows stood around him, crying, showing him the robes and the other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was with them. Peter sent them all out of the room. He got down on his knees and he prayed. Turning toward the dead woman, he said, "Tabitha, get up." She opened her eyes. Seeing Peter, she sat up. He took her by the hand, helped her to her feet. Then he called for the believers, especially the widows. He presented her to them alive. This became known all over Joppa. Many people believed in the Lord. Peter stayed in Joppa for some time with a tanner who was named Simon. She didn't do any big thing. She just sewed coats. And then there's the Apostle Paul. He's in prison. His situation looked pretty dire. And he writes to Timothy in 2 Timothy, the 4th chapter, at verse 9. And he tells Timothy he needs to do something to serve him. Now listen to what he asked Timothy to do. "Do your best to come to me quickly. Demas, because he loved the world, has deserted me. He's gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia. Titus to Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark. Bring him with you because he's helpful to me in my ministry. I sent Tychicus to Ephesus. When you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas." That wasn't a big thing. Unless you're Paul. I guess the conclusion of all of this is don't seek to do great things. Seek to do the things that you can do. In Matthew, the 23rd chapter, there is a discussion of what it will look like in the day of judgment. I want you to go home this afternoon, read Matthew 23. It's interesting because Jesus confronts two groups of people. One group of people, he praises because of what they have done. And what was their response? "Lord, when did we ever see you in prison and come and minister to you? When did we ever see you naked and give you clothing? When did we ever see you in need of food and feed you?" The people who had done what they could, who received the approbation of Jesus in Matthew 23, were people who said, "You know, I really never have done anything." And Jesus says, "Inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." And then the other group of people said, "We would have done it for you if we'd seen you in prison. We'd have come and ministered to you. We'd have done these great things. Jesus says, no, you wouldn't. You didn't do it to the least of my disciples. We're not like Diotrephes. Diotrephes wanted to have the preeminence among people. In John, the third John, the first chapter, beginning at verse 9, the apostle talks about Diotrephes. He says, well, this is the description that he uses for Diotrephes in the New International Version. He says, Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will not welcome us. Ananias and Sapphira, they wanted to do some great thing. The end of the fourth chapter of the book of Acts talks about how the Christians in Jerusalem, they had traveled from all over the world. They'd heard the gospel, and now they're stuck in Jerusalem. It's not like they could go home because they can't take their Bibles with them and continue to learn. If they're going to learn more about this way that they have adopted, they're going to have to stay here where the apostles are, and they can teach them, but they don't have any way to support themselves. So Christians who lived in and around that area, if they had lands or houses, they sold it. They brought the money and gave it to the apostles and said, here, take care of these people so they can stay here. Ananias and Sapphira saw what was going on, and they wanted to do something great. Well, kind of wanted to do something great. They sold some land. They brought part of the money that they got for selling their land, gave it to the disciples, and presented it as if that was all. You remember what happened to Ananias and Sapphira? Immediately struck down dead. Peter said, you had the land, you sold it. It was yours to sell. It was yours to keep back part of the money. That's not the issue, that you kept back part of it. The issue is you lied to the Holy Spirit. Because of it, they died. Serving in the kingdom is, in some ways, kind of difficult to get your head around. Because most of the service is not something that you'll read about in the newspaper. Most of it happens over your kitchen table. Somebody needs help and you give them help. Somebody needs comforting and you give them comfort. Somebody needs someone to talk to, and you're that kind ear. Somebody needs to learn about Jesus, and you tell them. That's real kingdom service. Having $1 million that you can donate so that we can find an end to this pandemic. A lot of ways that doesn't matter as much as what you did around the kitchen table. Well, I tell you, being in the kingdom, when Jesus said in the kingdom, it's like this. Being in the kingdom is a special, special place. And we want to impress you with how special it really is, how much it's not like the kingdoms of the world. I was watching television one day, and you know, you watch the president when he does something, and there's always somebody that walks behind him carrying an umbrella so he won't get wet. It's one of the military guys generally holding an umbrella out like this because you don't want the president to get wet. Well, I watched a man who was high-ranking official come out of one of the buildings in Washington, D.C., and there was a woman who was struggling to hold up her umbrella. You know what he did? He walked over, he took her umbrella, and he stood in the rain and held the umbrella over her. that service. The scepter by which Jesus rules is a wet towel. I can't imagine that if Jesus was here and it was raining cats and dogs, that Jesus would ever turn around and look for somebody to hold the umbrella over him. I think Jesus would have picked up the umbrella and made sure that everybody stayed dry. This is a kingdom that's hard to imagine, but we want you to be a part of it. I think it's appealing, frankly. I don't think a lot of people understand it. I don't think a lot of people are willing to give themselves first to the Lord. And if you do that, then all of this service that we're talking about just comes naturally. That's what Paul said when he talked about some of the early Christians. He said, in their deep poverty, their liberality abounded towards others. Why was it possible? Because they first gave themselves to the Lord. Now, it may be that what we're describing in terms of service is appealing to you. You can't get there without first putting on Jesus. So we want to give you an opportunity to do that. We want to make sure that you can put on Jesus in baptism so that this kind of service can be yours. It won't be unless you put on Jesus in baptism. We want to help you. Let us know that we can help. Of course, everything is goofy right now. We can't figure out how to sing because we're worried about the pandemic. Trust me, we can figure out how to baptize folks. We'll still make that happen. So if there's anything we can do, we want you to let us know.